Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Larry Rutter. Today, our guests are doing things that couldn't be more of a contrast, but both, I think you'll agree, are endlessly fascinating. One has had a career in all aspects of entrepreneurship and has some great insights.
For the most part, if you look at entrepreneurs don't like risk. They take risk because you have to, but they don't like it. As a matter of fact, they want to minimize risk. The key to being an entrepreneur is to get as much risk out of there as you can so you have a chance of success.
Our other guest has affected some major changes in a local theater company.
Over the last few years, we have really made an effort from the ground up to ensure the artistic consistency of our project, every production that we do. And that was my goal a few years ago, and that's completely restructured the staff, restructured how productions are mounted, just so the theater could regain artistic consistency and control of the products that we went on stage. And I believe after 3 years, people now have a trust in us as a theater group.
I hope you'll stay with us and meet a couple of very interesting people doing exciting things on Issues and Ideas. I'm fascinated with what I see as a whole new model for creating and building a business that's kind of emerging around the country. What attracts me are the way entrepreneurs are using the concept of the crowd, as in crowdfunding or crowdsourcing. Programs like Kickstarter come to mind. In some ways, the idea have taken root locally, especially in some of the activities for the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Cal Poly. Some very exciting things are going on. So I invited the head of the program to join us here. He's Jonathan York, or John York, a professor at Cal Poly's Business School and a former entrepreneur, I gather. Welcome.
Thank you.
San Luis Obispo, it seems to me, has been the home of some very successful entrepreneurial enterprises. I'm thinking of Kinko's and Mind Body, Jamba Juice, Spice Hunter. Is there something in the water around here? Is there something that we have that's unique, or is every college town in the United States have a similar story to tell?
Well, I think that the startups we've had here have been great, and we need a lot more of them. Probably every college town has its own share, because in some ways that's sort of what college is about. It's coming up with new ideas. It's being innovative. It's taking risks. What better time to take a risk in your life than when you're young and have less to lose in that sense? Although I think that, you know, our location sort of halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles is also a bit of an advantage at times.
Mm-hmm. What about, I suppose, land may be cheaper here than it would be in L.A. or San Francisco for an operation to get past the crib death stage?
Possibly it would be. I think wages are a little bit lower as well, although I don't think anybody's ever going to say that the cost of land anywhere in California, at least on the coast, is a strategic advantage when you're competing with, you know, places inland that in the U.S. So what it really is the kind of quality of people and the innovative and entrepreneurial environment that is in California that many of the students come to Cal Poly with.
And, it, of course, it is a school that has a large engineering a part of it, a large agricultural, hands-on kind of learning experience, just sort of generally.
And what we've been trying to do through the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship is find ways to sort of bridge the gaps between the different colleges at Cal Poly. One of the most encouraging things, I've been at Cal Poly about 5 years, and 3.5 years ago we restarted a group called Cal Poly Entrepreneurs, which is an on-campus club, and you know Cal Poly has lots of clubs for different things, but this club has over 1,200 students on its mailing list, and they are predominantly from engineering, business, agriculture, all the different colleges. It's not just stuck in one place. And if you look at the history of entrepreneurship and innovation, almost every successful new business has people with different backgrounds in it. It's not a solo job.
Mm. And is there something else about the school that sort of engenders that kind of thing? Is it part of the curriculum in a sense?
Well, I, you know, Cal Poly prides itself on what it calls learn by doing. And as a former entrepreneur, entrepreneur and someone who didn't come from Cal Poly originally, I just call that a bias for action and doing, which means that basically people aren't afraid to get their hands dirty. They start right away with actually using the tools, whether they're computer tools or physical tools or intellectual tools, and applying them. And that can really speed up the whole process of innovation.
And my sense is that in the last 5 to 10 years, nationally, there's kind of a whole new model or way of thinking about entrepreneurship. And I mentioned it earlier about the idea of crowd, the involvement of the crowd. Have I got that right? And is that part of the aura that you guys are working in now?
Well, definitely. I think a few things have come together to make it very different starting a company now than it was probably 10 or 15 years ago. One is that the technology tends to be much more accessible. Obviously, the internet and web-based technology has changed information technology startups, and you can do them a lot cheaper and a lot faster. And because they're in the cloud on the internet, you can fix them constantly. You don't have to ship CDs to people and all of that. But even in the area of physical products, we're now getting into 3D printing, rapid prototyping, all kinds of ways that you can bring stuff forward very quickly. And then we combine that with the internet's ability, which gives you the ability to reach people anywhere who might be interested in what you're doing. So rather than having to like just go around your hometown and find the 20 people who want the product you can build, if you get it out there and make it available, you'll find people across the whole world. And that's where the sort of crowd comes into it.
Explain to our audience how things like Kickstarter and other crowdfunding operations work and why they're so intriguing right now.
Well, there are really two kinds of crowdfunding, and I'm going to talk about the kind that's most common now, and that's Kickstarter, Indiegogo, and a couple other companies. And basically, that's where an entrepreneur, an innovator, or anybody can basically say, here's what I want to do. Here's what I want to build. Here's a movie I want to make. Here's an album or record I want to produce. Here's a trip I want to take, for that matter, and basically allow anyone in the world to contribute towards that. They don't own any piece of it. They're not owners of the company. They're not buying stock in it. But what they're saying is, I like what you're doing, and I'm willing to give you a little bit for it. Now, in exchange, usually the people get something back. So to give you an example, personally, I recently saw a 3D scanner, which is a device which will allow you to, rather than a flatbed scanner, which does paper, will allow you to put an object in it and do a scan of it so you get a 3D image of that object, which you can then manipulate and put into a 3D printer and print it out for yourself. So, you know, it's a pretty powerful thing. I thought, I want one of those. Well, these people hadn't built it yet. They had some prototypes. They were working on it. So I was willing to go in and give a certain amount of money to them for the right to get one of the first ones that comes out. So in the past model, they would have had to produce the scanner, get it to a store or sell it online, manufacture a lot of them, and then hope they sold. Now, they can go out there and say, wow, 25,000 people want one of our scanners. Each one of them put the money forward. Now we can go forward and build it. So it really flips the model from having to build it and then sell it to, in a sense, you're selling it and then building it.
Mm-hmm. Are there salient examples of successes in this kind of a method?
We had a really successful Kickstarter project right here in San Luis Obispo with a former student and someone I've worked with quite a bit. He happens to be one of a large group of people scattered across the world who play a game called Settlers of Catan. And if you play it, you know it. If you don't play it, you've never heard of it. I'd never heard of it. But he realized that one of the problems in that game was that it's a board game, sort of, but the boards that were developed for it don't hold the pieces or something. I'm not even sure exactly what, but he came up with a design and said, I want to build a new board for Settlers of Catan. Now, in the past, he would have had to go to a manufacturer, get it built, box it, send it to stores and all that. Instead, he went on Kickstarter, did a great Kickstarter campaign, and raised, I think, over $300,000 to help them build the first boards and get them out to people because they could reach people all over the world that played that game. He didn't have to go to a store.
And these were people that contributed, were people that were playing the game.
Were playing the game. And they thought, I like that idea. I want to get one of the first ones. And some people paid more so they could get a specially signed version. You know what I mean? There were all kinds of choices you could put in.
And this is one example, and this was became a financially successful enterprise?
It's in its way. I mean, now the challenge that he has is he's got to build all these games. He's got his prototype. He's got his molds. But now they have to go produce them and ship them. But they will. And so now they have a business.
Are there any examples of businesses that did a Kickstarter or a similar thing, and you can say this is a successful ongoing business?
Yeah, there's a company right now called Pebble, which makes a watch. It's an online connected watch that, you know, basically will take your text messages, et cetera, et cetera. They raised millions of dollars, and now they're a very strong ongoing concern. Huh. But in the past, they would have had to go to an investor, and the investor would have said, prove people will buy it, and they would have had to spend a ton of money up front before anybody had ever bought the thing to make it. Now, they're, in a sense, like I said, you're finding out if there's a market for it that way and selling it, and people are investing, and they do it for other things too. An actor recently just raised several million dollars to produce a movie because people wanted him to be able to do another movie, and in the tens and twenties of dollars they came in and said, I'm willing to do that, I'll get assigned an autographed picture of you or something for it. So
yeah, and actually one of the advantages is they don't have an equity share in the project. If you went to a bank or you went to somebody else, they would say, I want a piece
or
a big piece.
Or I'm going to lend you money, you have to pay me back. And in this case, you don't have to do that. I mean, you're relying upon the crowd, which, you know, means that you can get lots of small contributions rather than one big one.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with John York, Professor York. He's head of the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Cal Poly. Also teaches, is on the faculty of the business school there. Your Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, a center at a university usually takes people from a variety of different disciplines and applies them to something, in this case, innovation and entrepreneurship. I got that right?
Exactly. I mean, we started the center a little over 3 years ago with the intention of finding the most motivated, innovative, and entrepreneurial students, no matter where they were on campus, and connecting them with the resources that they needed to be able to fulfill their dreams. And if that dream was starting a business, that meant we would connect them with other students who could help them, with faculty, with mentors, and with even possibly helping them find funding and support if they needed that. So the center is a support organization and an educational organization that cuts across the whole campus.
Do you actually offer courses as part of the center, or you draw upon the courses that
we are not a teaching arm of the university. We're an applied arm. I mean, we obviously do a lot of education. We do workshops. We do seminars. We do six times a year on campus. We put on an entrepreneurship forum for the community, and we get a lot of people from the community. We had one on crowdfunding. We've had them on social entrepreneurship. We've had them on changes in energy and entrepreneurship and all these areas, and we get people from the community and faculty and students. So I would say we do a lot of teaching, but we don't give any credits.
Can you identify a student that you think has the substance to be an entrepreneur or the talent or whatever? Can you identify them?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that go into being an entrepreneur. And generally, you know, people say, well, it's something you're born with. You have to be born with taking risk. And that's not really true. For the most part, if you look at entrepreneurs don't like risk. They take risk because you have to, but they don't like it. As a matter of fact, they want to minimize risk. The key to being an entrepreneur is to get as much risk out of there as you can so you have a chance of success. So rather than saying they just blindly jump off an airplane without having a parachute, no, they'll check their parachute and they'll make sure it's a parachute's going to work, and they'll make sure that they're not too high and all that. Then they'll jump. Some people won't even go up in the plane. So I think entrepreneurs are people who are willing to go up in the plane and figure it out. In terms of students, a lot of it is drive. Do they keep coming back when they get smacked down? Are they willing to be coached? Do they ask for help? I like to think that entrepreneurial-oriented students, they like to lead, but they know when to follow. They're pretty competitive. They want to win, but they also know that they don't have all the resources they need, and they're not afraid to go out and get them.
I have a different notion of an entrepreneur, which is somebody who is not other-driven. It's somebody that dances to their own drummer, hears their own bells and whistles and theme songs, and is kind of oblivious to other people.
I think you may be thinking a little bit more of an inventor than an entrepreneur. You know, there are inventor entrepreneurs, but most successful entrepreneurs have to work with other people, have to find a way that their idea or what they're working on touches the world and touches other people. So they have to listen. They have to listen to customers. They have to get out there. Now, the other thing about an entrepreneur that I want to sort of make clear is that not all entrepreneurs have to have the idea. They don't, you know, sometimes the best entrepreneurs find other people's ideas and take them forward. Steve Jobs did not invent the personal computer. Steve Wozniak was the man who was putting it together, and Jobs is the one who figured out how to get it to customers and do that with it. And that's just one example. They don't work alone, and they often aren't the idea person, but they know when there's a strong idea that can be commercialized, they know how to get it done.
I'm going to get this all wrong, but there was an article in Slow Life magazine that I just had delivered to our door about the fellow Stollmeyer, I believe his name is, who is mind-body. Interesting story, incidentally. If you haven't, if you got the magazine at home, read it. It's a fascinating story. But that's a perfect example of it. The basic idea was not his. It was a fellow that he partnered up with who lost interest in the enterprise.
And if Rick hadn't come in there and figured out how to take what was probably a good idea, but you know, there's a lot of ideas out there, and turn it into a business, there wouldn't be a mind-body now. And so, and is he an entrepreneur? You're darn right he's an entrepreneur. He may not be an inventor, maybe, but I think we always sort of, I don't want to put such pressure on people. I have students say to me, well, I can't be an entrepreneur. I don't have good ideas. And it's like, you know, the best entrepreneurs find other people with good ideas and figure out how to make them work.
We're talking with John York. He's head of the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Cal Poly. And you got my attention because I heard about your accelerator program for this summer at what's called the Slow Hothouse, Hothouse for Business, I guess it's called. Let's start out talking about that. Tell us, what is the Slow Hothouse? It's actually a hothouse. I mean, it's a house, isn't it not?
It's a building, and it gets hot in the summer, but we use that term because we feel like we're helping grow seedlings in there. About 3 years ago, we were working with students on campus during the school year on some very interesting ideas they had and some really interesting concepts that they were starting to figure out how to make into a business. And in about June, the first year I was here, all of a sudden they disappeared. And I said, well, that isn't the way entrepreneurs work. They don't stop for the summer. And they said, well, we had to go get a job. You know, we had to get an internship. We had to do something. And I understood that. So 3 years ago, we had a great conversation with some of our funders and donors for the center and said, well, can we do something to entice them to stay here for the summer? And we did. We got some space. We raised a little bit of money. And we said to those students, you know, here's some money so you can eat ramen and you don't have to be, you know, be impoverished. Here's some mentors. Here's some space. Build your business. And this is now the third year we've done it. Last year we started, got some space available at 955 Morrow downtown, right? Used to be the Department of Public Works for the city. It had been sat empty for a couple years. And we did the summer program in there again, and we called it the Hot House Accelerator. And what happened, there was a lot of people from the community, Rick Stollmeyer from MindBody among them, Clint Pierce from Madonna Enterprises, and many others said, well, this is great. Don't close it in September when you go back to school, because the students go back to on the campus, and we help them on campus. So the community pitched in so we could keep it open year-round and make it available for community entrepreneurship. And then in the summer, we bring in seven more Cal Poly student startup teams, and they have 3 months to launch their business with help.
So all the teams are sort of concentrated in this one space.
Yep.
They must interact a lot.
They interact a lot, and that's the beauty of it. The beauty of it is that when you get a lot of because startups, it can be a lonely business for one, and it can be a business where you don't know what you don't know. And so getting them all together, it creates a little bit of a peer pressure kind of thing. You know, how far along are you? Have you talked to as many customers or potential customers as we have? Have you learned what we've learned about? And the businesses aren't competitive, but the people are. And so also it gives us a way that when people from the community come in as mentors, that, you know, they're there with everybody. And now we've got community businesses working in there too. And so that adds another layer of sort of expertise.
Community businesses?
Yeah. So there, we have a co-working space in there. And basically co-working is a way for people who are generally either working from home or working on a small startup somewhere else to share a workspace. So it's a shared workspace. You're not renting renting. And when you're co-working, you're not renting a particular office or desk. You can come in anytime, get a space, use the internet, use the printer, you know, connect with other people, use conference rooms. And we've got quite a few, and we're going to add more co-workers in there as well.
Mm-hmm. But this summer, you'll have seven nascent enterprises.
Seven nascent enterprises is exactly the way to put it. Yep.
And will they be in, I guess, in, they have to be in physical proximity to each other.
Yep.
How do you have discipline? I know that's the wrong word, but how do you get them to stop playing ping pong or foosball or whatever it is and concentrate on their project?
Well, I don't think you can ever get them to stop playing foosball. You've just got to make sure that you've got a set of goals and objectives. And we have mentors. Each team has a mentor. Most of them are very successful Cal Poly alums, some from the area, some from Silicon Valley, who come down several times during the summer and talk to them almost every day and help set up the kind of objectives that we're going to meet. It's kind of work hard, play hard. The one thing you'll find is that once things get going, it'll be, you know, people will be there. They don't show up at 6 in the morning, but they'll be there early in the morning till late at night. So there's time to work and time to play, and it's back and forth.
You had a sort of a funding campaign to get some seed capital mm-hmm. for these people to operate. That was been going on this spring. It was an Indiegogo campaign, as I read. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things, you know, we were talking earlier about crowdfunding and how you can use it to start products. And we thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we gave everybody who cared about Cal Poly and our alumni, no matter where they are in the world, and people in the community, a chance to have a little stake, not necessarily an ownership stake, but an emotional stake in the success of these seven really, really fascinating student startups and the young people who are in them. And so we thought, well, let's do that through crowdfunding. Let's make it available. Let's get the word out there. And we did a really good job. We learned a lot. It's a whole new world. It's a very different way of fundraising. I've been involved in the past in lots of fundraising, both asking and giving, and it's very different because it's all digital and all virtual. And, we learned a lot, and we had over 125 people who contributed, and some of those people were brand new, and now they know what's going on.
And are they from all over, or are they part of the Cal Poly community?
Well, you know, for the most part, they were part of the Cal Poly community or the San Luis Obispo community. So I would call them the Cal Poly community, too.
Uh-huh.
But we, you know, if we ever do this again, we will find ways to get even people who don't know about Cal Poly to get excited about it and do it.
Now, there are seven different enterprises mm-hmm. that you're working. We'll talk about all of them. But give me some example, or give our audience some example of one or two of them, what they're looking
sure.
at and what they hope to
sure.
achieve.
Sure, and every year it's different, because what we do is through the year on campus, we have lots of opportunities for students to start building upon their idea and building upon their business, from an elevator pitch competition to something we call the Hatchery, which is a on-campus kind of incubator where students can be working on their businesses. But by the end of the towards the end of the spring, we open the applications up for the Hot House Accelerator. We got 30-some applications. You have to have a business already operating. You can't just come up with an idea. You've got to have taken it past the idea stage.
Okay.
And we chose seven. One example, let's see, is a group that's made up of students from food and nutrition and students from the College of Business and Graphic Communications who've come up with a new product that enables children, mothers, to make sure their kids eat their vegetables. And essentially, it's a fruit leather, but it's made out of vegetable and tastes like fruit. So they're going to try to go to market with this and figure that out. And that's one extreme. At another extreme are some students who've got an application, and it's an app, which will help people who share housing, like roommates, whether college or, you know, after college, manage everything from their finances to their materials. And they've come up with some really great interfaces for that. So, you know, we've got everything from apps to products.
I noticed one called Sponge Creek.
Yeah.
Sponge Creek.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
This is a product developed by some architecture students with, I think, a material science student in there as well. And they've come up with a very interesting form of concrete that can be fundamentally built with a sponge and water and some materials. So it makes it able to be formed easily and shipped very easily. And it's very, very early stage. We're going to work on some, obviously, some patent stuff and some market stuff. But we thought that they just had had they had the kind of drive that was needed for this, because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for someone who's going to, you know, not take no for an answer. It's going to keep pushing this. And because when you start a business, usually what you end up with isn't what you started with. You know, you think you're going to do X and you end up pivoting and doing Y. It may be similar, but usually it's pretty different. It's either a different product or different customer. So we need persistence and determination, and that's what they really brought to the table.
Are you bringing in any experts for them to bounce ideas off of and whatnot?
Yeah, we've got some architectural experts. We've got some construction experts, some people from construction management at Cal Poly. We've got one of our alums who's very involved in one of a very large construction and development company up in Silicon Valley. So yeah, we've got people who just help them with sort of the whole business model. So mm-hmm. we try to get one lead mentor coach for each company who's sort of like their almost like the chairman of the board in a sense, but then bring in all the other resources, help them identify what they need and bring in those resources. So for a software company, we'll have people who are much more involved in sort of software development processes like that.
What about financing, long-term financing? Do you lead them in any direction there?
Well, I think that one of the goals in the 90 days they're in this accelerator is to come out with enough of a plan to understand how much money they're going to need and where it's possibly can come from. So we've had several companies get financing afterwards.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Jonathan York. He is head of the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Cal Poly. Let me go back to you and put your own innovation and your own entrepreneurship hat on. You had a little bit of personal experience as an entrepreneur, I understand. Was it a good experience?
Yeah, it was a great experience, and I've continued with it. I mean, I didn't know when I started the first company I started, I was not the age these young people are. I was older. And it was right at the start of the dot-com boom. And the internet was coming out, 95, 96. So
you were early.
And there wasn't a lot of discussion of entrepreneurship as like there is now. There was an entrepreneurship magazine and entrepreneurship this and entrepreneurship that. But it was the same kind of thing. And, you know, like anything else, I probably made every mistake I could possibly make. And the resources weren't as available. I mean, think about it. When you're starting out companies that are going to change the way things happen on the internet, that almost implies the internet isn't really solid yet. Whereas now, you know, these young folks starting businesses have no excuse of not going online and finding out everything they can possibly find out. So when I've sort of dedicated my time after that to helping other people start their businesses whether it was as a board member or a consultant or spent time in the venture capital business. And it was 5 years ago when I had the opportunity to actually turn to teaching.
And but you still keep your hand in terms of
definitely.
Innovation?
Definitely. I mean, I'm involved, well, obviously, with all the young startups that are here, but I'm still involved with quite a few others that from the past and have a network for it. I mean, you know, I have to do that in order to be able to teach that. Mm-hmm. I have to do my research, and I do research. I have to do my practical experience, and I have to make sure that we continue to build the resources we need for Cal Poly's entrepreneurs, which is generally people. We've got to bring people in to help, and that's what we've been doing.
Well, Jonathan York, this has been a fascinating discussion. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Thank you.
If I were a younger man, I would be on board as an entrepreneur myself, but failing that, I can live vicariously from it, and I appreciate very much your coming here and sharing this with us.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Now, one other thing before I forget. If people still would like to contribute to your campaign for the Accelerator program, can they still do that?
Yeah, the Indiegogo campaign closes because those are fixed-end campaigns, but mm-hmm. they can go to slohothouse.com, and there's a link there to contribute.
All right, very good. Again, Jonathan York, thank you very much for spending some time with us. It's been fun.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Larry Rutter. Support comes from the local California strawberry farmers, committed to investing in a sustainable future for the Central Coast and the Golden State. Information on the California Strawberry Commission is available at californiastrawberries.com. I think it's generally agreed that one of the cultural jewels of the Central Coast is the San Luis Obispo Little Theater. And it's been pleasing and often dazzling audiences for something like, I don't know, 66 years. It's a great institution. And I think in the interest of candor, I should say that I was once employed by the Little Theater for a brief and not very felicitous period. But we all move on, and the theater just announced its offering for the next year, and the first one being directed by the theater's managing artistic director, Kevin Harris. So I thought it would be high time we met him and got better acquainted. So welcome to the microphone, Kevin Harris.
Thank you very much for having me, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. You know, I looked at your bio. You studied under David Manna, mm-hmm. William H. Macy, among others. You've got degrees from NYU and Iowa. Mm-hmm. Years spent in the theater, a lifetime really spent committed to the theater.
As long as I can remember.
All right. My question is, mm-hmm. what were some of the most stellar moments? What are the, give me an idea of one or two of the moments in theater over the last, oh, I'd say 15 or 20 years yeah. that you can't let go of.
When I was a sophomore at NYU, I was studying under David Mamet and William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman. We were very lucky at the Atlantic Theater that all three of them were still there. They had founded the company. And they had a very rigid formula for how actors should act. They had a basic four-point formula based on Mamet's book, A Practical Handbook for the Actor. And he believed that you could break down acting into four easy components and that there was no emotion involved at all. And so while the training process was wonderful, it was also rather frustrating at that point in my development. And I remember going to the Public Theater, getting some free tickets to the Public Theater, and Stephen Burkoff had directed a production of Richard II. And I had never seen anything at the Public before, and I'd never even heard of Stephen Burkoff. I was 19, and that production, there were no rules to what he did on stage. The actors were doing things that I didn't think were even possible. They just tore apart the text and illustrated this beautiful play, one of Shakespeare's most lyrical, beautiful plays, in such a physical, visceral way that I walked out of the theater realizing that nobody knows what they're talking about. You know, anything is possible. It's if you can just imagine it and justify it and be true to the play, there are no rules. It's always about being true to the play. But other than that, you can do what you want.
So a production of Richard II mm-hmm. did it for you.
Did it for me. It changed everything. Changed my attitude in class. You know, I took everything with a little bit of a grain of salt and just opened up my mind and realized that what works for me as an actor, because I studied as an actor to begin with, what works for me as an actor is different than what works for any other actor, because we're all complete individuals. And then there is no magic formula to acting. It's whatever produces the greatest result for you.
I can imagine David Mamet mm-hmm. as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But William H. Macy, I can't imagine him as a teacher.
Well, he is such an amazing actor that as a teacher, he's like a different person. You know, often in movies, some of his most popular characters are these stammering, bumbling, you know, ne'er-do-wells who are always, you know, tripping over floor mats and making the wrong decisions. And in real life, he is just a rock. He is steadfast and brilliant and so articulate, and he was actually the one of the three major teachers there that, you know, almost it seemed like behind Mamet's back he would tell us, you know, you're going to have to learn how to do your own thing eventually, but while you're here, you better do what we say.
Were you ever tempted to stay in New York and make your film or your acting and directing career there?
I was. I was lucky enough to be able to graduate early. I graduated in 3.5 years, so I had 6 more months in the city where I really had to really stick around in order to be there for graduation. And I was involved in 3 productions in that 6-month period, and they were 3 of the worst productions, the worst productions I've ever been involved with. These are storefront theaters off of Houston Street, these tiny, you know, tiny theater companies with some of the worst directors, and ill-advised theater, you know, based on bad plays, bad ideas, bad direction. And after 3 months, 3 productions and 6 months of doing that, I knew that I wanted to come back. And I'd known that over at Centerpoint Theater Group is a theater that used to be over on South Street where the bus station was. And I knew Marie Garcia, And she was running that theater, and she offered me a position for the summer. And I said, absolutely. It'd be great to go back home for a summer, but stayed for a little while longer.
You certainly have. Other moments in the theater that stand out to you in your career?
Oh, sure. I remember when I was – the reason why I got into theater to begin with was, you know, my freshman year in high school, and I wasn't involved in any theater before that. And I remember being in my first play and going through that experience of putting on a live production with a group of people. I didn't know anything about the mechanics of it. I didn't know how to do it. And so really the drama teacher at AG High School, Billy Houck, really took me under his wing. And he had a great, great thespian troupe at that point back in 1989. And I had never felt more comfortable than in that the first time I stepped into a rehearsal room, and it was a very tangible feeling, and that was a life-changing experience for me because I knew that that's where I belonged, and I haven't left since then.
You spent some time, I would say, pondering and paying some attention to theater in the Middle East, mm-hmm. according to your biography. That sounded very interesting. Is that been an important part of your development?
Absolutely. It really struck me by surprise, that entire experience. At that point, I was getting my graduate degree in directing from the University of Iowa. And I had artistically pigeonholed myself, and I could feel it happening. I was directing the similar types of work. All of my work started to feel the same, and I was getting locked into a style because I was getting better at directing, but I wasn't challenging myself at all. And we had a guest artist come out from the West Bank to teach us, you know, more Eastern theater, more of what, which is completely different than obviously the Atlantic Theater Company, and completely different than what I was learning at that time at the University of Iowa. And much like that Berkoff play, working with her opened up my mind all over again. It reminded me that no matter how old you get, no matter how much you think you have it all figured out, You always have so much that you can learn, and you never know when that moment of inspiration is going to shatter what you believe is true. And I believe as artists we have to do that over and over and over again. We can't force it. We just have to wait for it and be open to it. And so when she said, I'd like for a playwright and a director to travel back to the West Bank over the summer and write a play with me and direct it with me for my company of actors in Ramallah, I said, this sounds like, when am I going to have an opportunity to do this again?
Wow.
Yeah. And I'd never been really out of the country besides, you know, Tijuana and Hawaii. So this was a much different experience.
And so what was the experience? What did you end up doing?
We ended up writing an original play in Arabic, which was the first challenge because all the actors spoke Arabic, called The Era of Wales. And the writer of that play, the playwright that I traveled back there, was Sam Hunter, and he just wrote a play called The Whale, won the Obie Award and the Drama Desk Award this year, and he's just exploding. And I know that his experience in Ramallah and the West Bank, he's been back a few times now. I was married, so my wife at the time was not too keen on me returning. She let me go that one time, and we had two small children, so it was a great experience, but wasn't going to happen again. But working with these actors, and especially having to work with these actors in a different language, you really learn what's important as a director. Working through a translator, you choose your words more carefully, and you really have to pay attention to what's going on in the actor's body. Even though I knew the script, I had a translation of the script, I didn't understand a word that they were saying. So as a director, you would have to watch a scene and say, do I understand this story based on just the physical interaction of these two actors? And it was a great, great learning experience because it's really easy to get caught up in the words, you know?
Of course.
And having to work on that very physical level was much different than, you know, the literal nature of Mamet's work and the scope of what I was learning at the University of Iowa, which as a director, they taught us to let our imaginations go. But as a director, you also have to have a plan. You have to have your production elements in place, and directing is very literal, you know.
Actually, I was thinking of Mamet. I mean, mm-hmm. his he's a, he's mostly about language. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is sort of what distinguishes him's writing from most other playwrights.
Absolutely.
Is the way he uses language.
Absolutely.
Or abuses it or whatever. So this career brought you, mm-hmm. you were at Centerpoint for a number of years, mm-hmm. and eventually came to the Slow Little Theater in 2008.
That's correct.
That right? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that running a theater company is like herding cats in a lot of ways, but you've survived 5 years. All right, what's your secret?
What's my secret? Wow. An enormous amount of patience, and being able to genuinely appreciate what everyone brings to the table. And I think that's especially in community theater, working with so many volunteers, really appreciating the time and the energy, regardless of the skill level that people might be bringing in. I've always had, luckily, and it came in very handy with this job and in other directing jobs and in other theater companies, I've always been able to navigate difficult political situations well. And I feel like I'm just straightforward with people, and I think especially in a community theater and especially in any real nonprofit organization, you know, there are always political ideas going on and there are always disagreements, and that's the structure of a nonprofit organization. So I believe my secret is to try not to take anything personally and focus in on the work. Make the work as good as you can possibly make it.
And you were quoted in the Mustang Daily a couple of years ago, and you said that when you came to the theater, it was in a transition from being a board-owned to a staff-owned company.
Mm-hmm. Like board-run and staff-run.
Okay.
Yes.
What does that mean, and what were the real-world implications of that?
You bet. Well, any nonprofit, but we'll speak specifically about theaters, go through these five stages of evolution. And the first one is a group of people getting together saying, you know, let's put on a play. I have a barn. We have the script. Let's do it.
Right.
And then, you know, eventually maybe they get their own space or they choose to put on a season of plays because they like the first one. But it's really those people still running everything. They're printing all the tickets. They are making all the decisions, choosing the plays, mostly casting themselves. It's still their hobby. When you get into the time where you get a nonprofit license, where you become a nonprofit organization, you have a season of plays, maybe you have your own space now. Now you're in stage three, and there are certain rules that you have to abide by when you're a nonprofit. And that's when the board of directors comes in. Now, typically, and in the Little Theater's history, this happened, you know, in the 50s, in the late 50s. Typically, those actors that had begun it, they move into board positions then. You know, they're a nonprofit now, but now they're on the board. But they're still running everything. Now, when I came into the Little Theater is in what I'd like to think of as stage four, where they had a small staff. They'd hired a chief executive to supervise that staff and to run the day-to-day organization. However, the Little Theater, and it's not unusual to the Little Theater at all, it's every community theater going through this, it was still very much a board-run organization. The board was still directly involved in the day-to-day operations of that theater. Board members were still supervising staff members, which is a dangerous precedent to establish in an organization. And it can't. We had a long-standing, wonderful board of directors who saw that theater. They helped that theater survive, some of them for more than 20, 30 years. But when a board or a staff gets a sense of ownership over a nonprofit organization, it will inevitably lead to some sort of disagreement and conflict, and especially when the staff becomes more professional, and especially when new board members come in. And so it was a very difficult transition period for the theater, but I truly believe it's stronger than it's ever been. We have a wonderful staff, an incredible board of directors, and we're going in on our third most successful every year has gotten more and more successful, and this last year has been the most successful ever.
We're talking with Kevin Harris. He's managing creative director of the Slow Little Theater, has been for about the last 5 years, I guess. I got my mathematics correct. You talked about every year getting better. It gets better for a number of reasons, and one of them is what you offer in terms of your offering. And we're going to talk in a few minutes about what the next 12 months proposes for the Little Theater. But I want to talk a little bit about the process of selecting. What's the trick of selecting a successful theater season?
Boy, I wish I could tell you that. As much as you know, this is in three different theaters. This is now the ninth season that I've been in charge of selecting, and I still don't know the secret. You know, you do the best that you can. I feel that especially with the Little Theater, it's our responsibility is the San Luis Obispo Little Theater to do everything that we can within our resources to provide quality theatrical entertainment to every facet of our community. And we made that decision a few years ago. That was really the big shift, that we weren't just going to be playing to this one demographic. You know, we were going to really do everything that we can to reach everyone that we can within our resources. And a lot of people were unhappy with that decision, because when you do that, you're going to be presenting things that certain people don't like. But it's our responsibility to present work that might speak to, you know, the next generation of theater goers, these 20-year-olds that we have to reach into their pockets to get them to spend $10 to come see theater. Why would they spend $10 for a theater ticket when there's so many other options? We have to produce something that they can only experience through live performance. So the process of choosing a season of plays, I have a very trusted advisory committee, the artistic advisory committee that I've selected, and we get together about 6 months before we need to make the announcement, and we talk about what's happening in the community. We talk about larger ideas first. What's the tenor in the community right now? What does the community need to see? You know, and then we'll write down 300-400 plays. And some of these are just plays that, you know, I would really like to do that. And some of them are, oh, I know this would be good on our stage, and maybe has nothing to do with what the community needs right now or what we perceive the community needs. Because on some level, we don't know. It's all just our perception. And we have to whittle that down to 5 plays. And it takes a good 3 or 4 months. And then eventually, if you're open to it and you the season begins to reveal itself to you, just like when you're directing a play. If you're open to it, what you believe the play is when you first begin rehearsals is never what the play ends up being, because the play will speak to you and the play will lead you. And when you're choosing a season, you'll begin to see these patterns and themes that resonate to the community in a way that you could never think about at the beginning. You couldn't just choose it, because the plays have to speak to you. And it's a difficult process.
And it takes you a matter of many months. The thing that has always puzzled me about theater companies is the penchant for doing everything that's familiar.
Right.
And it has always struck me as odd, because if you look at movies or you look at other forms of entertainment, classical music, we'll set that aside for a second, it's always new. There may be a sequel involved in many cases, but it's all new. But with the theater, it's tends to be a redo of the same stuff year in, year
it's
out.
A strange
it seems
phenomenon.
To me you guys mix that pretty well.
We try to. With this last season, we're right in the middle of our run for Sound of Music, and it is a beautiful, beautiful production of Sound of Music, and I hadn't seen it on stage in many years, and I remember going to one of the first run-throughs of it, and I was struck. I had forgotten just how good that play is. Just like, it really, really works, and it packs an emotional wallop.
Incidentally, I have heard from a number of people unbidden that they thought it was a fabulous production.
Thank you. Really very, very proud of it. Zach Johnson did a remarkable job of making that play work in our space. But we knew going in we're doing Sound of Music because it's a great play. We would never do a classic or a known moneymaker if we didn't really feel that it was a quality piece of work. But we knew that doing Sound of Music would give us the leeway to do, you know, a couple plays this season that we knew weren't going to make money. You know, Enchanted April, even though Enchanted April was a light comedy, it's not a play that a lot of people have heard of. We were able to do The Best Man this year, which is a 3-hour Gore Vidal play about a political convention. This isn't Oklahoma, and we were able to work that into our budget and produce these great plays. And I think that over the last few years, we have really made an effort from the ground up to ensure the artistic consistency of our project, every production that we do. And that was my goal a few years ago, and that's completely restructured the staff, restructured how productions are mounted, just so the theater could regain artistic consistency and control of the products that we went on stage. And I believe after 3 years, people now have a trust in us as a theater group, where they will buy season tickets or buy tickets to something that they haven't heard of, because they know that even if they don't like the play, if they end up not liking it, it's still going to be a quality production of that play. And that's the greatest trust that a theater company can have.
We're talking with the managing artistic director of the Slow Little Theater, Kevin Harris. You have a number of other things that you do aside from your main stage productions. Your Academy for Children's Theater is always struck me as a great asset in the community.
Yeah, it's going on its 15th year now, and our Academy of Creative Theater's coordinator, Carrie DiMaggio, is just a wonderful leader of that program. It's a year-round training program for young performers. We offer 8 to 10 after-school classes throughout the year. We have our summer camps coming up, 2 full productions. And we have just an amazing group of kids and future actors and technicians and future everythings, you know, learning valuable social skills and learning how to collaborate in a group. And we have big plans for that program this year. Very, very, very proud of that program and the work that Carrie's doing.
Yeah, but both a summer season and then an ongoing season as well.
Then an ongoing season as well. And we have a winter show, 2 full productions. They're doing Shakespeare shorts this summer. And it's just great to be able to expose the kids to the work of William Shakespeare. And the director of that production, Sheila Guerin, she's been directing for us for many, many years. And she's just an incredible spirit.
Seems to me at one point she ran the Academy.
She did.
Yeah. Huh, interesting. Another thing that you are involved in that somebody whispered to me several weeks ago, and I had never heard of it, and so I looked up the No Shame Theater. That is really interesting.
It is a lot of fun. It is a lot of fun. And this is a perfect example of doing everything that we can to reach out to every facet of the community. We wanted to get the people who are out on a Friday night, but they go downtown to the bars. How do we get them to theater? First of all, we make it free. Second of all, we make it completely unpredictable. No Shame, it takes place every 4th Friday. It's something we started 2.5 years ago. To much controversy, when we started it after our very first No Shame production, several letters to the editor, several letters to the board, several past associates of the Little Theater saying, you know, this smut does not belong on our stage. We need to, you know, does the city council know that they're subsidizing this building for this nonsense? And it really took me by surprise that those reactions would be out there, especially for people that didn't actually take the time to see the performance. But that's neither here nor there.
Now, just describe what the format is.
You bet. No Shame. We take the first 15 scripts. So at 9:30, the doors open. People are lined up. The first 15 scripts, and they can be anything. We don't even read them. As long as they follow 3 rules, they have to be under 5 minutes long. And at 5 minutes, the lights go out and you're off the stage. They have to be 100% original, meaning you have to have written it or you have to have written permission from the author to perform it. And the only other rule is you can't break anything, including the law. And these aren't our rules. No Shame has been around for going on 25, 26 years. It's in 50 different theaters, over 50 across the nation. It was actually started at the University of Iowa because the undergrads were tired of not getting cast in productions. And so they took a pickup truck, put it out to the parking lot, and just did their own plays and came up with these rules.
And so can it be a monologue? Can it be a multi-character play?
It can be anything and everything. We have musicians, we have stand-up comics, we have tap dancers, we have yodelers, we have piano players. It can be anything, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful mix, because you never know what's going to happen at a No Shame night. And if you don't like something, you know, some of it is not good. Of course it's not good.
Most of it is not.
Some nights you hit it out of the park, and some nights you're like, oh, man, I never thought 5 minutes could be that long. But it's only 5 minutes. So if you don't like something, if something's bad, it'll be gone before you know it, and then something else will come up. But it's really become a wonderful, wonderful night, because since it is so late, it gives these actors and technicians and the larger theater community. We have actors who take caravan up from PCPA and from the Melodrama and down from Pewter Plow. And it's a great opportunity for once a month all of us to get together for free, because we never do that. You know, we're also busy with our own organizations. And it is vital that we get together as a larger artistic community just to complain or just to commiserate, just to know that we are experiencing this shared experience, and just to celebrate theater.
We don't have that many more minutes left, and we haven't even dealt with the coming season and your contribution to it as a fundraiser. The first offering starts July 12th, Why Do Fools Fall in Love? Mm-hmm. Now, describe that as briefly as you can and get me all excited about it.
You bet. Why Do Fools Fall in Love? If anyone saw the marvelous Wonderettes from last year, it's by the same author. It is a rockin' 60s bachelorette musical. Takes place at a bachelorette party for girls who've known themselves forever. Contains about 15 of the greatest songs from the 60s, girl group stuff, boy group stuff.
And Why Do Fools Fall
in Love? Why Do Fools Fall in Love? My Boy Lollipop, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is, of course, the first act closer. Because the bachelorette party, there has to be some problem with the wedding. We're not dealing with high art here. What we're dealing with is a fantastic, you know, a fantastically entertaining 120 minutes with four of the funniest actresses I've ever had the chance to work with at the Little Theater. It's a wonderful, wonderful play.
It sounds really terrific. Mm-hmm. Among the other things that I noticed you're offering is, of course, Miracle on 34th Street. That's your, I guess you call that your Christmas production.
Yeah, that'll be our holiday play this year. Yeah,
that's very familiar. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really blows my mind is the season-ending production of A Chorus Line.
That's right.
How are you going to stage that at the Little Theater?
You know, we went around and around at the Artistic Advisory Committee, you know, thinking about how that's going to happen. And we wouldn't have done it without the right director and choreographer in mind. And that's Zach Johnson, who is an incredible, incredible choreographer. He directed Oklahoma. He did our production of Sound of Music. And he brings an artistic sensibility. What he did with Oklahoma to fit, you know, a play that typically has over 40 people in the cast. He got it down to 17, and it did not feel small at all. You didn't miss one. In fact, it really changed how you look at that play. And Sound of Music, you did a wonderful job as well. And the dude can do anything. And so this frightens me. It does. It frightens me to have a chorus line on that stage. And I know that they've done it before, because years ago. But I would really... I can't wait to see what Zach comes up with. We're just in the very, very early pre-production talks. But what we're most interested in now, and you know, what keeps us up at night, is we need to find 15 amazing dancers who can
15.
Also sing.
15, wow.
And who can also act, you know, triple threats.
Yes.
And they're out there. They're out there. But we are a volunteer organization. And trying to get 15 triple threats, you know, to have the same 6 weeks off is going to be interesting. But I know Zach will do a great job, and it's going to be such an exciting play. There's such wonderful energy in that play. It's just going to make 888 Morrow Street explode.
You have five offerings plus your fundraiser for the next year. We haven't got time to talk about them. How can people find out more about the season and season tickets and all those kinds of things?
The best way to find out what we have going on at the Little Theater, we have stuff going on there 44 out of 52 weekends every single year. So chances are we have something going on right down the road. Easiest way, just Google San Luis Obispo Little Theater. We'll be at the top of the list, www.slolittletheater.org. We have a beautiful website that you can explore all of our different programs, our children's program, No Shame. We haven't even talked about Ubu's Other Shoe, which is our stage reading program entering its 10th year. We have an incredible season lined up for their 10th anniversary. We have something going on. Check out our website. See what we have. I guarantee we have something that'll appeal to you.
Kevin Harris, Slow Little Theater, Managing Artistic Director, thank you very much for sharing this last half hour.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
This has been Issues and Ideas, heard every Wednesday from 1 to 2 o'clock on Public Radio for the Central Coast, KCBX. This is Larry Rutter.